people always ask, like, why didn't the New York Times create BuzzFeed? Why didn't Nordstrom create Rent the Runway? Why didn't TripAdvisor create Airbnb? All of these companies have the kindling, but they don't have the spark.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
One of the topics I get asked about often these days is NFTs, digital goods, and virtual goods, which are overlapping topics and not exactly the same thing. Well, in any event, you asked and we listened, so let's talk about those. I asked leading commerce expert Holden Bale to come on. He's a group vice president and head of commerce at Huge, a global experience company I've covered for years and even lost pitches to back when I ran an agency, but that's another story. Holden lives and breathes this topic, so you're absolutely going to learn today about the future of digital goods, whether or not these are a fad or a long-term trend, which companies are innovating in this area, and much more. So let's jump right in.
So Holden, welcome to Future Proof.
Thank you, Jeremy. Glad to be here.
Yeah, and I'm really excited for this. Want to ask you, the way we always start out, who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
My name is Holden Bale, and I lead the commerce practice at Huge, which is an experience and growth acceleration company and part of Interpublic Group. I'm responsible for any work we do that involves a transaction, that involves an exchange of value, generally between a brand and consumer. And so with that very wide definition, our focus and my time ranges pretty broadly from leading strategy projects for brands to designing and developing consumer experiences to helping leaders leverage the right technologies and processes to improve their capacity to do interesting things. I also sit on the advisory board of the Buy Nothing Group, which is a great organization pushing forward the circular and giving economy. And then unrelated to work, I'm a huge professional basketball fan and growing up wanted to be the starting point guard for the Miami Heat. Had to turn that down to do what I'm doing today.
I think you could probably still get a job as the starting point guard for the New York Knicks because I think that job's been vacant for about 25 years.
I will say no, I don't want to throw any shade at Kemba. I think Kemba's a very nice person.
Very nice person. So I'm excited to have you on because I think that one thing that so many people are talking about now is virtual goods, digital goods. And I'm wondering, tell me if I'm wrong, but there definitely seems to be a lot of interest there. There's some questions about whether or not this is sustainable or not, but why will entirely virtual goods become a thing or will they become a thing?
Well, I'm bullish on this. So I'm gonna make an argument for yes. There are two reasons that I would argue that they're going to become a thing, and they're very interrelated. First, we are going to be living more and more of our lives virtually. You already spend a great deal of time looking at a screen, but our kids, many adults, spend a great deal of time in virtual worlds on those screens. You know, the internet was a government subsidized project, but virtual worlds are going to be subsidized by the private sector. And there is a borderline ridiculous amount of capital in this space. And there is something to be said for the idea that supply will create demand, whatever you may think about Ready Player One. The second argument that I would make is that people care about their identity. We spend money on our identity. We spend money to reflect and project our identity, the cars we drive, the clothes we wear, the colors we choose to paint our living room. Less practically than those examples, the collectibles market is over $400 billion, depending on how you define it. Some of that is speculation, but a lot of that is reflection of identity. And if you combine those two things, some portion of people are going to spend, and many are in fact already spending, some portion of their time in virtual worlds, and almost everyone is going to have some element of their physical experience augmented by virtualization, commerce will happen because commerce has always happened where people are.
Yeah, it's interesting because I come from a background in the beauty industry where people spend a lot of time trying to beautify themselves in order to reflect who they feel that they truly are. And I think that, so to that sense, it's a continuation of something that we've always had in our society. But of course, in a lot of ways, like this discussion about immersive technologies in the metaverse, it brings the question of now you can be anything, right? Now you can change right. Everything. And I think that's very appealing to some people. What evidence do you have that, you know, when we're thinking about the entirely virtual goods out there, what evidence do we have that they're compelling enough that they're going to have staying power and that they're not just like, this is pretty cool because it's novel?
It's a valid question. And the allusion to beauty is quite interesting because beauty has a particularly interesting scenario to think through with the quote unquote metaverse. But I think it's funny, if you think that identity doesn't matter virtually, think of the amount of psychological energy people of a certain age put into what their AIM screen name was. If you could have captured that energy, we'd still be using it to power a small city. But to answer your question directly, I think it's helpful to contextualize the size of the market to begin with. So NFT sales in 2020 were something like $95 million. Last year, they're almost $25 billion. And I appreciate there's a very real speculation argument to be made here. But virtual goods don't have to be NFTs on the blockchain. NFTs don't have to be virtual goods. They could be shares in a company or a token you buy to get some physical product or access to an event like a concert ticket. But looking at NFTs is a decent proxy. Also, we think virtual product revenue in gaming has to be north of $20 billion. Most companies won't break this out, so a lot of it is anecdotal, but Activision was just acquired by Microsoft. They've been reporting something like $1.2 billion a quarter in what are mostly microtransactions. Because of the Epic and Apple lawsuit, it came out in testimony that Epic made over $5 billion in 2020 on Fortnite. That's all in-game transactions, battle passes, skins, that kind of stuff. I'd say it's less a question of staying power and more a question of what of the market is actually addressable to brands that aren't producing items for virtual worlds or games or experiential activations and communities inside of virtual worlds or art. And it's a question on the consumer side of what are the major inflection points for adoption beyond the ones we've already passed, because we've already passed several. There's the prevalence of microtransactions in games. There's the prevalence of what are basically virtual patronage currencies in platforms like Reddit and TikTok. And what is the education around what it's going to take for consumers to purchase a virtual good, especially if it's on the blockchain and requires crypto, and how easy will that technology be to use?
I was actually talking during my day job, talking to two different teams, the marketing and advertising team and the retail and e-commerce team. And we were talking about digital goods and NFTs and where should that be covered. And in some ways, it is a revenue driver right now already. But then at the same time, how much of a revenue driver is it? And right. What percentage? I think there's enough evidence to say it's never going to entirely go away. There's zero chance of that. But the question is, how big does it wind up growing? And let's say somebody like me who has way too many shoes, the future version of Jeremy, is that somebody who, instead of having almost 60 pairs of shoes, do I have 30 virtual pairs of shoes or 300 and I just have 10 physical pairs? Can you change consumption behavior to that extent? Do you think that the big players have the ability to change consumption behavior based off of how much money they're throwing at this?
So I would argue that there's a corollary to the rise of what we would call digital natives. There's a corollary to the rise of e-commerce, right? What largely happened, legacy brands treated it as a bolt-on. Okay, I'm going to go do the e-commerce stuff now. And a common question brands are asking themselves right now is one of the ones you're referring to. Do I just need to plan to have a virtual corollary of every physical product I sell? Probably not in most categories, but it might be the case in apparel. You buy a new pair of boots, your avatar gets it in their inventory. Okay, easy enough. That's gift with purchase. But if you get a pair of Nikes and you pay whatever it costs, I believe it's approximately $1 bazillion to hydro-drip them, and they are truly one of a kind, maybe you create and register an NFT for that. That's unique. You want to create a virtual companion to the physical good. You want to prove ownership. But what I'm interested in seeing, and I think like T minus a couple of months until there's a bunch of thought leadership and books about quote unquote virtual natives, and that'll be the new term instead of digital natives. There are companies that I think will come into being and brands that will come into being, and we're already seeing it with brands like the Bored Ape Yacht Club, that move in the other direction. They started through virtual goods and they start entering the physical world, either physical events or physical products. And they're going to challenge the notions of these boundaries between virtual and physical in the same way that digital natives challenge the boundaries between e-commerce and regular commerce, and e-commerce being a nice to have as opposed to a main value driver and main channel for consumers.
It's interesting to me that there have been a number of different brand activations lately where they're tying the purchasing of the physical and digital goods simultaneously together. And it almost seems to me like this is a way to wade into those waters when you're not quite sure if somebody's going to actually purchase something digital that doesn't have that physical corollary. But I'm wondering if you think that's going to go away and eventually those things will be more separated.
I would argue that some of the best expressions of virtual goods are intrinsically combined with physical experiences and physical products. So what Adidas did with their Into the Metaverse event recently was very interesting. It pulled on a lot of levers, community, exclusivity, both in terms of what the virtual goods they sold, which were NFTs, promised, which was access to limited edition physical products, access to private virtual events in 2022, and in terms of what it required to buy them. Their early release was for people who had previously had an Adidas token or a token from one of their design partners. To me, that was one of the more experientially complete examples of how you can operate in this space. It wasn't, here's a JPEG, come get it. I'm going to do some marketing around this so I look cool. I mean, there's another angle to this, which is a bit of an aside. We predict over 50% of brands will be advertising inside of digital world in some capacity in the next 3 years. And I guess that's the addendum to my earlier statement. Commerce has always been where people are, and so has marketing.
Also, when you think about that, there are just a few companies that are doing some interesting things that everybody seems to know about, or at least everybody in our space, but then there are some unsung players. Which companies are you watching most closely that you think are going to be impactful to the future of digital goods? And this can be on the platform side, on the developer side, anything.
Walmart. I paused for effect. I wanted to let that sink in. So I'm very serious. There was a shift maybe 4 months ago where companies started to respond to people ripping off trademarks to create virtual goods. It got some press in December because an artist created NFTs that looked like the Hermes Birkins. And then, and this is like an Onion article, the artist complained because people were creating ripoff NFTs of his NFTs. So brands that have the money, and especially if they have cultural equity, which is very much true for fashion and luxury brands especially, got serious and are getting more serious about trademark. But in that window, right at the end of the year, Walmart filed several very detailed trademarks, including for the creation of virtual currencies. And when you think about their scale and their capacity for innovation, and Walmart doesn't get enough credit for innovation, they just aren't very public about it, they could really do something that would be seismic for the market. Coming back to beauty, the brands for whom you'd say intrinsically, oh, virtual goods make no sense at first blush. What is Taco Bell going to do? Or a beauty brand? What virtual good am I going to buy from a beauty brand? And so I like the beauty brand example a lot, and I appreciate you mentioned it. It might not be clear what the value proposition is, but take Glossier, right? What were they when they started? They were a community and a content brand, not a beauty brand. They organized around beauty before they produced beauty products. What would it mean for them in the context of virtual goods to strip down to those first principles of content and community and reframe the virtual goods question in that light and how they can leverage their brand in that light?
It does strike me that people who are naysaying digital goods are overlooking the fact that, yes, there are core things that have to be taken care of for people, like they need shelter, they need food, all that stuff. And then we've often invested in luxuries that we didn't quite need. It's just more so things that we were brought up to think that these were things that were important. So under that logic, if you're brought up thinking that particular digital goods are important, then you're going to think more about them from a value standpoint. And those are the things that you are going to value. And again, this is the generation that's probably, you know, one below where you and I are at. It's a little bit of a hypothesis that we have, but I think it there's a lot of reason to believe in this.
And it's not going to be a perfect growth curve. And everybody should go into this eyes wide open. There's going to be a lot of stuff that makes you roll your eyes. There are two very good, very recent articles about this that both fall in the same story. The New York Times did an article about gamers who are skeptical of NFTs. And The Information did something similar about sneakerheads. Both of the articles hinge on the perception of value. There's no long-term sustainable market for creating virtual goods that feel like money grabs. There is, and has proven to be, a very real market for virtual goods that create consumer value and enrich an experience. But like with what Adidas did, which is you are basically buying into this NFT for a promise of future community and future experience and future exclusivity, there are a lot of promises that companies need to deliver against to prove out this model and to prove out the potential of it.
And that's one of the themes I feel like we always come back to, is that everything old is new again, because there are some underlying principles of consumer behavior that are going to hold true for the digital goods world. And I think one of those things that I think is an interesting topic tied to this, gifts with purchase. How do you imagine virtual gifts with purchase have the potential to transform retail and improve retailers' margins? Because I think that to me is a huge opportunity, is if you basically say, okay, you're buying a whole bunch of quote unquote physical good, old school goods, and then we're giving you something that we've developed with love and care, but it's still high margin, then maybe that has the potential to change the fortunes of some retailers that have, you know, been beset by COVID the last few years.
I think you go back to the Nike example. Say you buy the shoes and you hydrated them. What if getting a 3D image of that cost $5? Or what if the image was free, but having it show up in a character's locker in a video game or in your profile on Snapchat or TikTok, or actually creating a token on the blockchain that proved you own it, what if that costs $5? That's the bolt-on approach, right? It's not as sophisticated as saying, I'm going to take a step back and sort of greenfield say, okay, what could my virtual product strategy be? How would I reconceptualize my business for the future of Web3? But what are the goods and services I could sell that are natural, logical augmentations? It's an obvious evolutionary step for a lot of brands. What if you're already planning some sort of event online or off, and the gift with purchase is the virtual token that gives you access to that event? Can we play with some dynamics that feel less like they're pure consumables? But I might flip this in another direction. Jeremy, you are the CEO of a $5 billion company. Let's say, I don't know, you're an everything store. You sell a lot of other people's stuff, but you have some private label stuff yourself. What if I told you in 5 years, 15% of your revenue would be virtual goods and services, $750 million? What would you do right now? What would you change? You even mentioned talking to the marketing team versus the e-commerce team. Should this live at the intersection of that? What would that mean for your business? These are the questions that I think companies and brands need to be asking themselves, because it's absolutely going to be the foundation of new brands that are going to come into existence just attacking this space.
Yeah, I agree with you to think about it that way. But I think that in some ways, that whole question about whether or not to partner with other people or do it yourself, a lot of that has to do, in my mind, as somebody who ran an agency, a lot of people are just thinking, well, how big is this going to be? And do we know how big this is going to be? And is this going to be core to our business or not? And if we're not sure yet that it's going to be core in the next few years, then let's partner with a best-in-class agency, like obviously you guys, shameless plug. But yeah, I think that some of it is, I do feel that there are some people who are just saying, oh, wait, take a wait and see, because we don't quite know where it should live within the organization. We don't quite know to what extent we insource versus outsource and partner. And I think a lot of people are still in that kind of, what is this going to be yet? I think there's like a quote from The Social Network that I'm going to bastardize, but it's, we don't even know what it can be yet, you know, like as a category. And I think a lot of chief marketing officers and leaders feel that they know something's there, but they don't exactly know how it's going to evolve.
I'll throw a quote back at you, which I believe belongs to Dwight Eisenhower, which is plans are useless, but planning is indispensable. And as somebody who's a recovery management consultant, I feel that every day. I feel it every moment.
I love that I quoted Eisenberg and you quote Eisenhower. Wow.
You got to bounce it back and forth. Obviously, there's going to be an ebb and flow to this. And when novelty wears off, if something fails, we say it was a trend. And if it wasn't, well, that's just how you do things now. So the internet wasn't a trend. The bucket hat was a trend. The iPhone wasn't a trend. Tamagotchis were a trend. Neopets were a trend, although honestly, Neopets would probably kill it right now if you brought it back. To me, what virtual goods represent isn't a trend. I'm predisposed to feel this way, perhaps. It's a new type of product. And Web3 represents a new frontier for experience. It represents where people are going to be. And again, I keep coming back to this idea, wherever people are, there is going to be true commercial opportunity. And I'm a big believer in, you should focus in on what you believe is core to your business, and you should ruthlessly be efficient about everything else. But by the same token, it is very, very rare that brands have an opportunity to truly innovate on their business model, like the rise of the internet. Is this going to be the same thing? And it's because of will, it's because they can't get the capital, it's because it's misaligned with their incentives, it's the innovator's dilemma, like whatever. And then there are some companies who feel liquid. They're always shape-shifting, like Amazon. You never really know what they are. They always start a new line of business. Virtual goods, but I think more broadly, Web3 presents a window to reconceptualize what your business could be in a decade. And a lot of businesses have the infrastructure to do this. They have the most important element of all, their people. Smart people with a lot of experience. If you're a retailer, merchants who understand trends and are young and are out there and are like consuming art. And people always ask, like, why didn't the New York Times create BuzzFeed? Why didn't Nordstrom, which is a company I love and I think is doing amazing things in physical retail, create Rent the Runway? Why didn't TripAdvisor create Airbnb? All of these companies have the kindling, but they don't have the spark. And I'm not saying Web3 and virtual goods are the spark, but they are certainly providing dry conditions.
Well, and good analogy. And yeah, to me, it's like a lot of those people didn't need to cannibalize their businesses at that moment. And because of that, they weren't creating the future. But then you have in a lot of situations now, like you see some companies are acquiring because they realize they might not be the ones to build it themselves, but they do know that it is the future and they do know that they need to cannibalize their own business to some extent. If you think about it, if Nike were to cannibalize itself through digital goods, that wouldn't be the end of the world because you're essentially moving to a higher margin area. The same thing with the retailers that have all of this physical infrastructure that they don't necessarily need. If they can move some of that virtual, then probably they're improving their margins. And that's why it seems like retailers have a huge opportunity here because they're just realizing that the future is not necessarily that great for them unless they try to innovate, frankly.
I think it's, where are people? Where are eyeballs moving? But I also think, not to recreate the notion that a rising tide lifts all boats, but when we're talking about virtual goods, what are we focused on right now? Art, digital land, an ability or a cosmetic item that augments a digital representation of yourself. It could be a gamified currency, like the reference to Reddit. For the most part, I think there's a separation of concerns here. And where you want to be as a brand is wherever your consumers are, wherever you can add value. And so that goes into things like the augmentation of the physical experience, but also the augmentation of the virtual experience. It is very cool that you can own one of these Adidas tokens, and I'm bummed I don't have one, to get access to exclusive products. Like, that is very experiential. That is very interesting. That is very fun. And that is not one channel cannibalizing the other. And it's funny, and I'm sure you feel this, and in some cases actually not funny. It was like an old joke about a retail first date. You don't talk about three things: religion, politics, and sales credit. The fact that we are still arguing about sales credit between physical retail and e-commerce, when people who are in Gen Z and you try and do surveys with them, like, literally can't answer questions about the distinction between the two, talks about, you know, that's us existing basically inside of an anti-pattern.
Exactly. Like, you're thinking about it through like an old school paradigm and not the way that people, that's why it's so important, I would say, to always have diversity generationally in terms of your hiring, obviously other types of diversity too, but just to see things through those eyes. One thing that I don't know if this is just me being old, I look younger than I am, but seriously, I think one of the things that is probably like my generation thought about is you try to display things that matter to you in some way, shape, or form. And that's, again, feel free to push back, correct me, educate me. But I feel like that's one thing where we still have a little bit to go with respect to digital goods in terms of how do you display them? What is the norm around that? Because maybe it's not going to be that important. Maybe just the fact that people know that they own something is going to be the way that it matters to people in the future. But it just seems to me like the display element of it. And I know that people have always historically purchased art and then left it in some random storage place somewhere. But I feel like the display aspect of it is a thing that we're not necessarily that far ahead societally yet.
That's valid. There is a tendency for us to poo-poo alternative notions of identity as we age. And you get a piece of artwork and it looks like an ape, and you have it be your Twitter profile image or your image inside of Discord for your avatar. That gives people who are part of that community something intangible, a sense of belonging, a representation of identity. And it's not so far away from having an Elks Club membership. It really is not that far away from that experience. But the question that you're asking about, how do I present my identity when they're digital goods, when they're things that like exist inside of my wallet, my Bitcoin wallet, yeah, that I can't show it to you. I think you're going to see more and more of a push towards people selling things like picture frames where you can show those off. But again, this idea of we are going to live more of our lives inside of virtual worlds, more of our time in the day is going to be that. And when I look at Jeremy, I'm going to click on Jeremy and I'm going to see all of the things that he has through that virtual world. Or I'm going to have headgear, which we've been making fun of for a long time and it should have been made fun of. And there's a reason why it didn't do well for a while. It was bulky and it was ugly and it was inefficient. If you look at CES, and we're finally starting to see the miniaturization of certain technologies inside of contacts. We're finally starting to see headgear that may come to the fore. If I'm walking down a hallway and I see you, and then there's an overlay on my eye that shows me your avatar ID, it shows me some of the things you have, it shows me some of the games you play, that is not substantially different in terms of lived reality from me looking at the clothes that you're wearing.
I think you make some pretty good cases in that regard. It's interesting. I could talk about this for a while with you, and I know you probably have to bounce in a minute, but this was really amazing. I think you probably won a few people over in explaining why this is not so dissimilar from some of the world that we've lived in to this point. Halton, thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you, Jeremy. Take care.
Thanks again to Halton for making the time. I really think that this is an important and interesting topic. And when you think about the similarities between digital goods and goods that have made up our identity since time immemorial, it really gets you thinking, is this really so different? If you like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Futureproof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to our producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Futureproof.